This is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, October 27th, 2017.
This is the Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, race and inequality reporter from CNN and CNN Money, sitting in for Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for being here with us. We begin this hour thinking about what it means to experience discrimination in America. It turns out most Americans feel their own racial or ethnic group faces some kind of discrimination today. That's according to a new poll about race and identity in America, and that same poll revealed something that took many by surprise. A majority of white Americans surveyed said whites in the United States face discrimination today. NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the T.H. Chan School of Public Health at Harvard surveyed just over 3,400 adults of all backgrounds. Of those, 902 were white, and 55% of that group of white Americans reported feeling discriminated against. We put this question to our white listeners. Do you feel discriminated against because of your race? And the majority of you said no.
My name is Kim from Pleasanton. And as a white person, I can say with certainty that white people have no idea what discrimination is.
Kylie from Orlando. I've never been discriminated in my life.
Sarah calling from Gainesville, Florida.
No, I do not agree. I recognize the privileges that I have from being white. Not having to worry when a cop pulls me over that he'll shoot me. I think they use discrimination against them to scapegoat their economic or social losses.
But some of you said, yes, I do experience discrimination.
My name is John. I'm from Ashtabula, Ohio. I've been discriminated against for being white. I took the test to get in the fire department. I scored highest of everyone taking the test. I was told I didn't get the job because they wanted a minority. I took the civil service test to become a postman. I got points for being a veteran, but the African-American sitting next to me got more points just because of his color. Yes, I've been discriminated against, and it happens all the time.
For some context around these issues, we turn to Dr. LaRue Lewis-McCoy, an associate professor of sociology and black studies at the City College of New York, and author of the book Inequality in the Promised Land. Dr. LaRue Lewis-McCoy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me on.
So let's unpack this. I mean, I cover this. I write about this. I live it. I'm a person of color. This idea that white people can be discriminated against or can experience discrimination, let's start with that. Is that even possible within how we define discrimination today?
I think the idea that white people can be discriminated against is possible and actually makes sense. Now, of course, discrimination is treatment based on another set of identities or the leveraging of power against someone. But it's important to recognize that oftentimes, as white Americans may experience discrimination, the magnitude of discrimination and the frequency of discrimination looks very different than people of color, particularly African American and Latino folks. So when white Americans start to say, we have been discriminated against, it may represent 1, 2, 3 experiences of discrimination. When you compare that to the experiences of African Americans, who on average may experience 5 dimensions of discrimination in everyday hassles, then we realize that we're talking about really a different beast.
So is this this idea of reverse racism, is that what we're talking about here? Or is that different from the discrimination we're describing?
Reverse racism falls into the category of discrimination, particularly for many white people who think about their experiences. So one of the listeners highlighted being passed over in a firefighter exam in a civil service test in which he identified the African-American sitting next to him got more points on the entrance exam. Now, I'm not sure how he knows that information or if that information is accurate, but he's taken that experience to be real, to be truthful, and to actually suggest that it changed his life circumstances. We often don't think about, when we talk about reverse discrimination around things like affirmative action, how frequent discrimination towards people who are black and brown and poor happens. And so when people have their first experience where they think they have been mistreated, whether it is legitimate or illegitimate, they see that as the only experience that matters. They don't see that someone who grows up in a community that has high rates of poverty, that have schools that have been failing, that don't offer AP courses, their lack of access to educational opportunity are actually the discrimination that matters most in providing access to jobs or equal pay.
Dr. Lewis-McCoy, yesterday I spoke with one listener named Jonathan.
I hate bringing race or anything into this, but if you are a white Christian male And these days, you are demonized.
He didn't want to use his last name. He's 32, white, from Beaverton, Oregon, and he says he feels discriminated against.
When I first actually heard about this idea, we were at a rally in Portland, and this white kid, maybe college age, runs up and starts telling my Japanese mixed friend, that he knows he was born racist because he's white, and he accepts that, and he feels guilty for it, and he apologizes. And then he calls my friends racist. I've heard that multiple times since, and I sat there thinking to myself, well, I'm white. I'm not racist. I don't feel bad about anything. And I've heard it from women, from dudes, and now it seems to be some kind of theme that is accepted, and if you don't accept it, you're a racist.
So what you're saying is, I just want to make sure I understand, that you personally feel hurt because as a white Christian male, you feel that people think you are a racist, just off the bat.
Correct. Instantly. And through that, they won't want to listen to you. They assume the worst of you.
Have you experienced any specific discrimination outside of the example that you just gave me? Like, have you experienced it on the job? Have you experienced it at other points in your life?
I've experienced this mainly at the Portland events. This is a very crazy town when we go out to do freedom rallies. I've been maced, spit on, told to shut up, told that I'm worthless. The first time was when I was around 15 or 16. There was a Hispanic girl that lived down the street. You know, we were friends at school. She was cool. We were all friends. But then every time she got home, you know, she wasn't allowed to come out and hang out or do anything with the other neighbors. You know, they were mostly white. And then she had her quinceañera, and she invited me, and she really, really wanted me to go. And I was a little nervous, you know, 15, I don't know Spanish, and you know, I don't know what the food's going to be like. And then I get there, I finally get the nerve to show up, and all the Mexican kids my age shunned me. Like, they physically tried to intimidate me out. And at the time, I didn't really think of it as racism. Maybe it was a cultural thing, but that was the first time that I had an experience with, because of my skin color, I'm lower or I'm not welcome.
So, Jonathan, what do you think about, I mean, because when we think about discrimination in this country, for Black and brown Americans, feeling discriminated against is sort of an everyday experience for many of them. Do you think that that's not the case?
I don't know anyone that discriminates against anyone. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I've only met one or two actual racist people my whole life.
And when you say actual racist, what do you mean? What do you mean when you say actual racist?
Oh, white people should stick to white people. You know, everyone should stick to their own. They were older gentlemen, and they admitted to being racist. They weren't hiding something. They weren't trying to bait me into being racist. They were just, yeah, I don't like that color. They should stick to their own type.
And you don't identify like that, do you?
No, I do not agree with any Nazi stuff or racist or anything like that.
Dr. Lewis McCoy, why do whites feel so on average, I guess, in this poll, so discriminated against and so on edge about being considered racist?
Well, one of the most dangerous words in our vocabulary is the word racist or racism, because somehow in 2017, we've gotten rid of all of the racists except for a handful of people who have outright hatred and bigotry towards another group. Now, as a sociologist, I know that racism is not about individual feelings. It's much more about institutional power. And so when you have someone like Jonathan who says, well, I've been called racist and white people are labeled racist, which in fact makes other folks who call them racist racist, we start to realize that the meaning of the word has been diluted and changed around. One of the things that they also found in the survey that I thought was really telling was they asked white Americans, if you've been discriminated against, what do you think matters more? Is it individual discrimination, or do you think it's governmental and institutional policies? And 61% of white folks said it's definitely all about individual discrimination. Only a quarter of white respondents said the government policies are discriminatory and maybe racist. Now, this is particularly dangerous because the bulk of discrimination that African Americans face, that Latinos face, and other people face doesn't come from interpersonal interaction daily, someone walking up and saying, I dislike you because of your background, or speak English today. Instead, it happens in the ways in which they're not incorporated into the fabric of American life.
So you're talking more about covert racism.
Right. I'm talking about covert, but I'm talking talking about institutions, what kind of schools you have access to when you are born Black and Latino, what kind of hospitals you have access to. So really, unfortunately, most of our discourse around racism, and part of it is connected to us emphasizing things like Charlottesville, where we can identify the, quote, real racist who marched around with tiki torches. I'm much less worried about people marching around with tiki torches in Charlottesville than I am with government officials who are cutting funding to key areas such as HUD.
What's also stunning to me in this is that we have more information perhaps now than we ever had, we being media consumers, media creators. We've seen things because of social media and technology. We're seeing things that perhaps were never seen before in terms of violence against communities of color. I'm thinking Michael Brown, you know, and on and on, and the videos that we've seen. So these ideas that this is hidden behind, you know, this is just happening in certain communities and no one knows about it is false today. I mean, I think because it's so obvious, because we've seen so much of this, how can we still have that cognitive dissonance between seeing what's getting played out on air and social media and in our daily lives and still refusing to sort of grapple with that? It just seems like we've been in this place for quite a while, and it doesn't seem to be changing.
Yeah, I think we've been in this place for quite a while, but I actually do think it's changing. It's getting a little bit worse because
It's
getting worse for a particular reason. We live in segregated housing, and we have segregated schooling experiences and segregated relationships. And so people don't often see discrimination unless it's played out in their life. They make exceptions for the things at a distance, and they're like, well, maybe they did something wrong. But now when you add in the influence of a thing like social media, which often spreads information but can spread actively misinformation, particularly for white Americans who receive information about gun violence, for white Americans who receive information about Antifa, they are seeing themselves under threat, and they're able to pull from often misinformation to say, we are the true victims now. Well, where'd you get your information from? I got it from Facebook. I got it from my Twitter feed. And this misinformation has also been in the form of mainstream media. So now I think we're in a similar place, but often a more dangerous place.
How much of this is about feeling threatened, if you will, with a loss of power? And when I say that, I say, you know, let's look back at the past decade where we had our first Black president. We saw many gains, you know, small and hard-earned gains, but gains nonetheless in terms of some sort of racial equity or confirmation of the fact that these things are happening and continue to exist. Is this about changing the power structure of this country, changing the tenor of race in this country and the discomfort that comes with that? Essentially, you know, if this country, and we know that it is getting browner every day, is this a reaction to that?
I definitely think a lot of this is a reaction to the threat of the browning of the country, but also the fear of losing power. And this, what we're often experiencing, is are the last gasp of what we call white supremacy as an ideology, which is the idea that those who have control, who have power, who are deserving of things are white. Now, most people won't identify as such, but when we see the distribution of goods, when there's so much income and wealth distributed towards white Americans, we see that people are saying, well, what happens if this power shifts? Now, as demographics change, we may see a browning of America. But what we don't often see is a change in power. And that political power is how we have to look at racism. And if we start to seriously do an analysis of who's in control of major institutions and whose interests are they acting on behalf of, we start to see, well, the demographic threat may appear to be real, as in we are getting less white, but the shift of power is not occurring. So we have to push back against this fear and these threats and really create a more equitable and true country that meets the ideals that were set forth that have never fully been the reality of American citizenship.
I think, you know, also I agree. And I think when you look at, when we talk about power, particularly in the United States, particularly in a capitalist society, that power is connected to wealth usually. And some of the numbers that I got for a project that I was working on from the St. Louis Fed about a year ago indicated that of the wealthiest Americans, the top 1% of Americans, about 95% of that top 1% are white. which leaves the remaining percentage filled with people of color, whether they be Asian, Latino, Black, et cetera. So when we look at that, when we look at the concentration of wealth, when we look at the concentration of power in our federal government even, whites still dominate. And now is this an economic question, right? Are these largely and we heard a lot about this group during the election cycle, the sort of white working class who are struggling with opioid addiction, who are struggling with unemployment. Is this that resentment coming from that?
There is a dimension of class, but far too much of the resistance to racial change or a fear of a browning of America has been placed on the white working class. And they've been seen as the people who are leading this movement. But when we look at things like who voted for Donald Trump, we see across the economic spectrum, and particularly those who are white and affluent, voted for Trump at disproportionate rates. So there is an economic tail as well. And part of it is that we think, well, if you are white and working class, you have it hard in America. You do, but when we look at things like wealth, we see that the white working class, on average, have more wealth than the Black middle class. So what that tells you is that how power is wielded today is it's really an intergenerational narrative, and it's who receives the spoils. And historically and contemporarily, Black and Latino folks are not receiving an equal share. So while poor white Americans may feel their situation is hard, and while they may experience the downsizing of industrialization and other things, their conditions on average still outpace those who are Black and Latino and actually getting, quote unquote, getting ahead in America.
And if I recall correctly, a couple of years ago, was it Diva Pager at Harvard did a study that showed that whites with a criminal history were more likely to be hired or called back than Blacks without a criminal history, if I recall that study correctly. So there still seem to be these big gaps in how we're treated. One question for you, too. One of the things that came up in the interview with Jonathan was that when I asked him, you know, did he ever fear for his life when he had been in, you know, come into contact with law enforcement, had been pulled over by the cops?
I've been pulled over a ton of times. I lost my license for 3 years when I was 18.
And what have those what have those interactions been like?
Depends on how I reacted. If I was cocky, they were a little bit meaner. If I was cooperative, everything was smooth. It was really just how I approached them.
Did you ever fear for your life?
I've had a gun drawn on me before, but no, I wasn't scared. I had my hands on the steering wheel. Never feared for my life, no. And I've had a lot of police contact, because after I drove, my license was suspended for 3 years. I still drove and drove and drove. So I was getting pulled over a couple times a week.
So, Jonathan, I think that's one of the differences between white and Black Americans in particular is how the rate with which police use force on African Americans is almost four times higher than the rate of white Americans.
I disagree with that, because if I would have got out of the car and ran, they would have chased me. And then once they caught me, depending on how much of a struggle, they're going to put their knee on the back of my head. They're going to wrap my wrist up. They're going to twist my leg, just like they're going to do to anyone who runs or who doesn't want to be cooperative. But I don't think the police officers wake up and be like, today I'm going to go get Black people.
Dr. Lewis McCoy, when I hear these you know, reasons, it feels very paternalistic almost. It feels like, well, Black and brown people just need to behave better and not get out of line, right? And yet we have white Americans who are sort of, you know, allowed to express the full dimension of their racial discomfort here. But it doesn't seem that seems to be allowed on the flip side, if that makes sense. I mean,
it does. It makes perfect sense. Oftentimes when we talk about feeling like you are mistreated, people may become angry. But we are now at a point where Black people, Latino folks, are not allowed to be angry. We have to be the perfect citizens to survive in everyday life. And that's a very dangerous and unrealistic proposition. I wasn't even 20 years old the first time that I found myself with a police officer pulling me over with his gun drawn. This is not a world that we want to live in. Instead of asking Black folks, Latino folks, poor folks to be superhuman and be perfect, we have to look at those who have power and say, why are you pulling over different sets of folks? It's not a question of who's driving while Black. It's a question of who's policing while white. We have to reorient our frames and make sure that we're not asking for superhuman ability, but we're really creating opportunities for people to live their lives free of harm and free of the fear of losing their life daily.
Dr. LaRue Lewis-McCoy, Associate Professor of Sociology and Black Studies at the City College of New York and author of the book Inequality in the Promised Land. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway. This is Tanzina Vega in for Todd Zwillick. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega of CNN. We turn now to the future of policing.
All right, what he's doing now, we call scrubbing the image, looking for clues as to where the murder is going to happen.
Original running bond brick pattern, streamline early Georgian details.
What are your prime directives?
Serve the public trust, protect the innocent, uphold the law.
The cybernetic oracle, the ultimate man-machine hybrid, programmed with every crime ever recorded and implanted with the brain cells of history's greatest detectives. We call him Pickles.
Okay, maybe we're not there yet, but we're actually a lot closer than you might think. Cutting-edge technology is changing the face of law enforcement. For example, police in some cities use data points about your life and your criminal history to predict whether or not you'll commit a crime. It's called big data policing, and it's happening now.
Big data policing is the use of new forms of predictive analytics, new forms of surveillance monitoring. That's changing the way police police. It's changing who they police. It's changing where they go on patrol. It's changing when they police. And in many cases, it's changing how they police.
That's law professor Andrew Ferguson. He's the author of a new book, The Rise of Big Data Policing.
Right now in patrol cars in Philadelphia and in L.A., police are now patrolling based on algorithms. And they take past crime data, sort of crunch it up into numbers, and they predict, they forecast where a particular crime will be at a particular time, and they send the police there, right? And some of the more sophisticated cars, literally as you drive from neighborhood to neighborhood, the screen changes in front of you, changes color in front of you. So you might go from like a blue, you know, aggravated assault neighborhood to a high theft area, and the little computer in front of you shifts from blue to green, so you know you're in a different area with a different particular crime problem. And so it's changing where police go.
So how do they know what type of data is being put into this algorithm? What's being fed into their system?
A lot of it is past crime data on the theory that some crimes are almost contagious, or some are somewhat viral, right? So burglary crimes tend to happen in sort of groups, right? If one house is burglarized, it's actually statistically more likely that other houses in that neighborhood are going to get burglarized. Same is true with car thefts and thefts from auto. Some of the more sophisticated models add in other factors. So, for example, they might add in weather when it rains. You know, bad guys don't like getting wet, so there's less robberies when it rains. All of these sort of inputs are added up into, you know, depending on the algorithm. Some are complex models and some are pretty simple models, honestly, and used to predict where crime may occur on the theory that if they get that right and they put the police officer at the right place at the right time, they could deter crime and they could reduce crime.
Now, the big question is, and I've talked to some law enforcement officials across the country who have varying opinions on this. Does it work?
We don't know. There are a handful, just a limited number of studies that have tried to evaluate it in the real world. And, you know, the jury's still out.
So there's the other example that you've talked about, which is the Chicago example and the heat maps that Chicago PD were using and then sending folks to people's homes based on that data?
So, you know, there's a place-based predictive policing, which is what I was just talking about, but there's also person-based predictive policing. And what Chicago is doing is they've created these heat lists, right? Individuals on a list of people who are the most or predicted to be the most at risk of violence. Either they're going to be the perpetrators or the victims of a violent crime. They are rank ordered, a score. You get a score. If you've been arrested in Chicago for the last 4 years, you have a heat list or a threat score from 1 to 500. And the people with the top scores, those 500 scores, on occasion get a knock on the door by a police administrator, usually accompanied with a social worker or someone from the neighborhood and someone from the community, to basically give a warning to that young person. Usually it's a young man. Usually it's a young man of color to say, look, we, the police, know that you are involved in this lifestyle. You have, you know, two paths ahead of you. One involves you being a victim of violence or being involved in violence. The other might involve getting out of this life and being involved in a, getting, social services or the rest. And this is your choice. In fact, we have a letter. It's called a custom notification letter. It has your name on it. It has your prior record. It has everything we know about you. And what we're telling you now is that you're at risk. And if you don't shape up, we're going to bring the hammer down hard on you if you get in trouble again. And this is a quasi-public health approach in the sense of they're trying to identify people who are at risk. But of course, the problem with a public health approach is you got to actually have the components of social services and the rest, which haven't really been funded to the way that I think many people wanted them to be funded.
I mean, let's be honest, though. Isn't that a bit invasive, patronizing?
Yes, I think it's I think that if you can just imagine being that person, you're sitting in your apartment, something that's a knock on a door, and a police officer says, look, an algorithm has predicted that you're going to be more at risk. That is a measure of social control, honestly. It's a measure of surveillance. It's a measure of police sort of recognition that they're monitoring you. And it is threatening in many ways. Literally, people are at your door telling you that you are now on this heat list. And I think that it is far more problematic than the place-based predictive policing, in part because the inputs that get you on this list involve, and this is the current standard, whether you have been arrested for a violent crime, a weapons crime, or narcotics, whether you've been the victim of a violent crime or an assault, your age at the last arrest, the younger the age, the higher the score, and sort of the trend line. Is this going up or down? Are you actually, being more involved in crime or less? And the problem with that is when you have arrests as your input, you are necessarily also dealing with how police do their jobs. How do they use their discretion to arrest people? And if you have a city like Chicago, which in 2017, the DOJ Civil Rights Division went there, investigated, and found a systemic, problematic, series of racial, injustice, both in terms of the structure and specific acts, that there's going to be a disproportionate bias in the outcome, right? So if your inputs have, implicit and explicit bias, then your outputs are also made biased, and you're going to pretend that it's objective when it's really not. And that's a problem, right? That's a problem if you don't recognize the dangers in these data-driven targeting mechanisms.
So then the question becomes, where's the line? I mean, if I happen to live in a certain community that happens to be full of a certain type of person, I'm more likely to come in contact with folks like that, whether they have criminal histories or what have you. I mean, I grew up in a very low-income community, so that likelihood is probably higher for me than it might be for other folks. And so where we draw the line hasn't really been demarcated yet in terms of our individual privacy.
No, not at all. In fact, the reason I wrote this book is I think that we have not, as a nation, been talking about this. We haven't recognized that these technologies are changing the way police are doing their jobs, of who's getting these systems or who's being collected in these databases. I view big data policing as both a civil rights issue because it affects different communities differently and affects communities of color differently in ways that we need to be paying attention, but it's also a democracy issue, right? We need to be starting to have these conversations and going to our chief of police and going to our mayors and saying, what surveillance are you using? What technologies are you using? How do you know they work? How do you know they're good? How do you know they're not, creating or reifying some of the bias that we know exists in society? And we need answers because right now we don't have answers in almost every city in America about the technologies that are being used right now on our citizens.
Andrew Ferguson is the author of the new book, The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement.
It's just so hard to wrap your arms around the fact that your child would do heroin.
She told me that day in the hospital, I'm not done using. And I was like, oh, hell yeah, you are.
It's not that OxyContin is particularly powerful. It's that pain is particularly confounding.
Every muscle and bone in your body hurts.
It's so important for the mental health and substance abuse issues to be treated together.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega of CNN and CNN Money. On Thursday, President Donald Trump declared the opioid crisis a public health emergency.
It is time to liberate our communities from this scourge of drug addiction. Never been this way. We can be the generation that ends the opioid epidemic. We can do it.
In 2015, more than 90 Americans died from an opioid overdose each day. That's 33,000 people in all.
Beyond the shocking death toll, the terrible measure of the opioid crisis includes the families ripped apart and for many communities, a generation of lost potential and opportunity.
Dr. Caleb Alexander is the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. He explains what the public health emergency designation means for people on the ground dealing with this crisis.
This type of declaration allows the Department of Health and Human Services to have expanded powers and authorities. So, for example, the department can redeploy federal workers or volunteers to areas that may be hardest hit. Or if there is funding available, it can issue grants to states and municipalities to try to improve our ability to identify and treat the more than 2 million Americans that have an opioid use disorder.
Is there funding available?
Well, there's not. And really, we're now depending upon Congress to pass legislation that would provide funding that could be in turn used by the Department of Health and Human Services to better identify and treat those with opioid use disorders and engage in a number of other initiatives to try to stem the tide of this epidemic.
So, Doctor, right now the administration is missing some key figures to help execute this plan. So, for example, there's no drug czar, there's no Secretary of Health and Human Services, there's no one leading the DEA right now. How does the absence of these key figures impact the efforts of the administration to deal with this crisis?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. But these are also very big agencies and very big departments, and there are literally tens of thousands of individuals that can be touched and affected and mobilized by this type of declaration. But there's no doubt that we'd be in a better position if there were a lead for the Department of Health and Human Services and for the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
The president did not take this a step further and declare the opioid crisis a national state of emergency. What's the difference between these two designations? Does one matter or does it not?
I think most public health practitioners actually think that the declaration of a public health emergency is the more appropriate way to go. This really has the potential to allow for the federal government to play a much more active and decisive role in addressing the epidemic. It's just that it's dependent upon whether or not Congress will free up funding to implement many, many different programs and policies that could be implemented through this type of declaration.
Dr. Caleb Alexander is the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. Thanks for being here.
Take care.
You can see all of our ongoing coverage of the opioid crisis at thetakeaway.org/opioids.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time.
It's showtime.
Showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
Everybody, showtime.
Showtime.
It's showtime.
Showtime.
It's showtime.
Showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
Don't say it, please. Don't say it.
No, I have to say it, Mitch. Showtime.
It's Friday, where we talk about what's hitting movie screens with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Hi, Rafer.
Hi, welcome aboard.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here. So, Suburbicon. Directed by George Clooney. I've seen commercials about it so far. It seems really interesting. Let's take a little bit of a...
Welcome to Suburbicon, a town of great wonder and excitement.
Hey there.
Built with the promise of prosperity for all.
So this looks like a little bit of a freaky, interesting film. Tell me about this.
Yeah, I think if you've seen the trailers, you're probably expecting some kind of a satire. You've got Matt Damon, who plays a family man in this 1950s idyllic suburb called Suburbicon. We don't really know where it is, but he's this guy who looks like the mob is coming after him. He's defending his home, trying to protect his family. That's not quite how the story goes, and I don't want to give away too much. That story's actually a little darker than you might expect. It's told through the eyes of the little boy, Matt Damon's son. I think the problem with this film is that part of it seems to have been written by the Coen brothers, and there's a second part of this film written by George Clooney and Grant Heslov, which is a civil rights drama about a black family that moves into this neighborhood, and the white families gather around, beat drums, yell at them, try to force them out, and at some point begin to hang Confederate flags on their house. All of this based, slightly exaggerated, but based on a real-life incident in Levittown, Pennsylvania back in 1957. I'm just going to say the Coen brothers' farcical, wacky film noir and the very earnest civil rights drama just don't go together.
I can't imagine how they might, especially in light of the current political climate and racial climate that we're experiencing right now.
I totally agree. I think Clooney and Heslov wanted to, I think, draw some very clear parallels. There's a point where the white neighbors build a large fence around, essentially a wall around their black neighbors, some of which could have worked as social commentary. But I think when you have these weird comedic aspects in it, it just doesn't hit.
Next movie, Thank You for Your Service, directed by Jason Hall.
This is our care package. Fill it out, and on review, you will be directed to a primary care physician and psychiatrist.
How long does that take?
Usually 12 weeks, but we're in arrears, so...
Arrears?
Yeah, we're backed up. It could be 6 to 9 months.
Are you kidding? You think these guys can wait that long?
So, Rafer, this is a different tone of film. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, that's Miles Teller playing Adam Schumann, a real soldier who is trying to get benefits and get help for his post-traumatic stress. He was an Iraq soldier, Iraq veteran. This is based on David Finkel's nonfiction book and directed by Jason Hall, who is the screenwriter of American Sniper. So you've got, I think, kind of a counterpoint to American Sniper here. That film was very intense, a lot of action, a lot of emotion. This film is much quieter. It's much more about these very humbling, quiet moments, about these guys who are suffering. They finally have to admit they need help. The Army does not come off very well here as a bureaucracy or as a cultural institution, not so helpful to these guys. But I think what I like about this movie is the quietness with which it tells its story, and you really get to know these characters and feel for them and feel how they're kind of bottoming out and trying to right their ship and get back into American life.
And is this sort of bringing to light that issue that veterans, you know, I think we have a lot of sort of unrecognized veterans, and the issues that they're facing are pretty, you know, under the radar. So is this sort of bringing that to light as well?
Yeah, I think that scene that you heard right there with him in a VA hospital kind of coming up against that sort of bureaucracy that we've all come up against, and that you feel that veterans in particular should not come up against, that is not something I can think of that I've really seen brought to the forefront in very many war films. War films generally in America, not that popular, especially about the Iraq War.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea of soldiers returning home with stress, also not a popular subject, doesn't tend to do very well at the box office.
And the idea that they may not be treated as well as we expect them to be treated, not popular either.
Not the kind of thing we want to confront, but I think this film does a very good job of it, and I do hope people go to see it.
Movie number three. Now, am I saying this right? Novitiate?
Novitiate, yes.
Margaret Betts is directing here. Tell us about this.
Very interesting film, kind of an unexpected subject at the moment. It's about a young nun played by Margaret Qualley, Andy McDowell's daughter, by the way, who decides to become a nun in 1964, right as Vatican II is coming in. So it's really about this young, idealistic nun, but she's also watching sort of the church go through this dramatic change. Melissa Leo plays the Mother Superior, who does not want that change to happen.
Obviously, if we tell you what the change is, we would give too much of the plot away.
Well, I think people probably know. I think if you grew up in the Catholic Church, or mea culpa if you used to be a Catholic.
Getting involved in that one.
That's all right. That's all right. But I think you know that Vatican II is the church that we know. It was essentially a modernizing effort. But it also, I think, took away a lot of this, the extreme practices, yes, but a lot of the specialness that I think went along with what it meant to be a nun, what it meant to be a priest. And I think one of the questions the film raises is, you know, what have we lost there? What, you know, in for the sake of modernizing, what did we lose in return? Really interesting film. Never quite goes where you think it does. I was really mesmerized by it. Melissa Leo could be an Oscar nominee for that. Wouldn't surprise me at all.
Interesting. A lot of conversation about the sort of, you know, where the church is going today as well, right? And the need
of course, where
our Pope is. And so that's a really fascinating take on that. Anything that stood out to you that you didn't like in any of these films other than Suburbicon or...
I liked all these films. I thought these films all had a little something to offer. I think probably your best bet here is Thank You for Your Service or Novitiate, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, we'll start to see where those end up. And I'm disappointed in what you said about Suburbicon. I have to
say.
Sorry about that. That's all right. Rafer, thanks so much for being with us as always. And, we look forward to talking next week.
All right. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print-and-marketing. Staples, it's pro time. And Fracture, creating modern photo decor by printing their customers' photo directly on glass. A Fracture is image, frame, and mount all in one, available in a selection of square and rectangle sizes. Learn more at fracture.me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, filling in for Todd Zwillick. We just spoke to Rafer Guzman about new movies. Another new one out recently, Wonderstruck, from director Todd Haynes. It represents a major departure for the director, whose past works are notable for their frank exploration of gay and lesbian relationships.
At Batten, I was astounded by the discovery that each male had a male of his own, and that the world of force and manly beauty loved in that way, within itself, from link to link.
That was a clip from Haynes' first feature-length film, Poison, which won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance in 1991 and went on to face the ire of conservative groups dismayed over its on-screen depictions of gay sex. Poison was one of several works at the time breathing creative life into the queer community as part of a movement called New Queer Cinema, a term first coined by critic and historian B. Ruby Rich.
Really, it was a very cinephile film that cared so much about film history and genres and about thinking who gets stigmatized, who gets scapegoated, and how has this been treated in history.
Ruby Rich is now a professor of film and digital media at UC Santa Cruz and the editor of Film Quarterly. And she helped to chronicle a wave of queer cinema that began in the 80s and has seeped into mainstream today.
It was an attempt to create a space in the popular culture that wasn't marginalized, that was really inventive, that was going beyond the old definitions of positive images, negative images, and really wanted to imagine life anew, give strength to the community, but also demand attention from the mainstream society.
And I wonder, you know, when we think about LGBTQ cinema, how important is the role of sex and sexuality in those films in terms of defining them as queer or not?
Well, fascinating. I think that sex has often been important to queer mm-hmm. filmmakers because it was for so many years either completely invisible or instead used as a place of shame or humiliation or stigma. And so I think that with the first kind of explosion of a new queer cinema, it was important for many filmmakers to have sex depicted, sex as an act. But it was equally important, I would say, to have emotional relationships depicted that included sex but went far beyond it. And so I think you find a lot of constructed families, people in films like Go Fish or more recently Pride or even right now Tom of Finland, having, you know, kind of chosen families in which sexual relationships can be accepted, in which eroticism and queer identity can be accepted. But it's also important to just have that fact made clear. I think of something like Jamie Babbitt's film in the late 90s, But I'm a Cheerleader, where the nuclear family sends you away to be cured, but the found family there allows you to find out who you really are. And so there's a way in which a lot of these hierarchies were stood on their head, and instead of queerness being defined only by sex, it was defined upon sex, but way beyond that as well, without having to split off one part from the other, without having to either be in the closet or be nothing but your sexuality.
And I want to talk a little bit about mainstream film and gay characters in these films, thinking Philadelphia, Brokeback Mountain. Are you disappointed by how queer and LGBTQ characters are portrayed in for mainstream audiences in films like these?
Oh, well, you know, we all have our own opinions, don't we? For me, Philadelphia was just much too soft. And yet for many people, that was an important touchstone film, particularly in terms of the Bruce Springsteen song in it. For me, Brokeback Mountain was a crucial film. I found it very important. Whereas for other people, it was too soft. It was selling us short. It was everything we didn't want. I felt quite the opposite. I felt that it was queering the Western and that it was doing something very important.
And I'm thinking about Moonlight. I think Moonlight was just gorgeous, visually gorgeous, but also it portrayed not just gay men, but poor gay men of color. And it seemed to grapple with what masculinity means in poor black and brown communities in a way that I hadn't seen before. Do films like Moonlight make you hopeful for the future of queer cinema, especially with this lens on layers of race and class and other social issues?
Oh, yeah. Moonlight is such an extraordinary film. It's such an exceptional film. And Barry Jenkins did such a brilliant, brilliant job with it. I think it really set a new benchmark for what films can do. I think that we're in a very inventive moment right now in terms of depictions of people of color. If the financing continues, if the audiences continue to go to them, which I really, really hope they will, I think that Moonlight is such an affecting film that does a lot of healing and at the same time presents an insider view that is not only about abuse, that is about survival, that is about dreaming a different world, really.
I agreed 100% with what you're saying, and I think that it was also sensual instead of overtly sexual, which was also, you know, the way that they handled that, I thought, was really amazing. You know, where the—
You're
where
absolutely
the, where
right.
The emphasis wasn't on the act itself, but that act was so powerfully transformative for the characters, as we see, you know, later on in the film. I'm wondering about, you know, I think about this a lot when we think about, you know, films made by directors of color in particular, and the concern, which is, do we call a black film a black film, right? And if we do that, do we isolate or alienate other audiences? Is there a similar concern talking or labeling films as queer that might alienate people who say, well, that's definitely not a film for me, so I'm not going to go see it?
Probably so. But, you know, there are insider and outsider treatments, and there are films that stay within a queer world and show at LGBT festivals, of which there are more than 100 around the world, and never get to a larger public. And then there are films that really do want to speak to a broad audience from a different place, from a different position. I think that the kind of work that we've been talking about really is that kind of work. It's work that, regardless of labels, is going to travel. You know, Americans are so bad about having more than one identity that I think that we fall into that trap a lot. Americans are very bad at intersectionality, as the academics like to call it. But in fact, we're all much more that way than we are reducible to a single definition. I always like to tell students, you don't know who you're talking to. You only see what they're presenting you in that moment. You don't know the backstory. You don't know the grandparents. You don't know the next door neighbor. You don't know the beating at age 6. You don't know who you're talking to, so don't assume that. And I think our films come to us the same way. We can't make those assumptions based, God help us, on the marketing campaign. And hopefully people will turn out for these films that are breaking through those barriers and giving us back, among other things, our childhood.
On that note, Ruby, thank you so much for joining us. And this was a wonderful conversation. I look forward to more.
Thanks for having me.
B. Ruby Rich is a professor of film and digital media at UC Santa Cruz and the editor of Film Quarterly. Thanks for joining us today. It's been great being with you. As always, we want to hear from you, whether we're talking about discrimination, big data policing, or queer cinema. Call us with your thoughts and stories and what you'd like to see us cover. We're at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, race and inequality reporter from CNN and CNN Money. Todd Zwillick is back on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is The Takeaway.